Well, joining me this morning to help us understand more about the issues surrounding the use of feeding tubes for the end stage of dementia is Dr. Sharon Brangman. She's a professor of medicine and the division chief of geriatrics for Upstate Medical University. She's also the past president of the American Geriatric Society and currently the director of the Central New York Alzheimer's Disease Assistance Center. Welcome, Dr. Brangman. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for inviting me.
End-of-life decisions are very challenging, but this one is a particularly so, I think. Tell us what the concern is.
Well, the concern is that toward the end of Alzheimer's disease, people lose their ability to chew and swallow and eat. And food is such an important symbol in most cultures and certainly in our culture for taking care of someone and loving someone. And so it's very hard when a loved one stops eating to know what's the best approach to take.
So when you're thinking about somebody who otherwise is functioning or able to locomote, like they're not necessarily bedridden, I mean, what does the patient look like?
Well, generally at this stage, the person isn't walking very well. They're probably bedridden and they need help getting out of bed. They may not be talking very much, maybe a few words at a time. Sometimes they recognize family, but maybe they don't. They usually don't have control of their bowels or their bladder, and they're starting to lose weight.
So the issue here really is something like the notion of putting someone on life support, like oxygen or an NG tube or something in other circumstances. Here you're talking about basically keeping them alive by putting in a feeding tube.
Exactly. So what do we do when we see somebody starting that downhill course, which is often indicated by losing weight and not being able to eat? And there's been a number of concerns about how do we use feeding tubes in these situations in patients who we know are starting that downhill course.
You say concerns, so there are ethical concerns here as well as professional concerns.
There's professional concerns because we know that it's very easy to put the tube in. It's a very simple procedure. It's often done right at the bedside with some local anesthesia. So on the short term, it's fairly easy to do. But on the long term, there are a number of complications, and with ongoing research, we're starting to question whether we're causing more harm than good by inserting feeding tubes into older patients.
So what goes into the decision? First of all, who makes these decisions? Obviously, it's got to be the team. I mean, both family and the physicians who are taking care of this person. Let's start with that. Generally, what have you seen?
Well, this generally happens in patients who haven't made their wishes known ahead of time. So patients who have told their family in advance or written it out whether or not they would want to have a feeding tube or other forms of treatment toward the end of their disease process gives us a clear course. It's the ones who haven't made that decision, and then families, usually alerted by doctors or nurses, that this person isn't eating, they're losing weight, they may be getting dehydrated. We know that physiologically, in terms of how the body is functioning, there are little signals that are starting to turn off organ function. So the brain isn't working very well, and the kidneys may start to slow down. And also the ability to understand what food is for and to eat is starting to change. So we find it very common for people to start to pocket food in their mouth. They may chew and then never swallow, or they may put food in their mouth and not know what to do with it. Or if they do swallow, they may start coughing because food starts to go down the wrong way and into the lungs.
So exactly. I mean, I'm trying to understand also from kind of a psycho-emotional point of view, what goes into the decision on the family side? I mean, what are some of the issues that you see that people struggle with?
So families are very concerned that if they don't do something, their mother or their father will starve to death or become so dehydrated and it will be very painful and they would feel very guilty about that.
So you're seeing it's like mom fed me. How can I deny mom food?
How can I deny mom food? Because food has such an important emotional tug in this culture. So what we have to do as physicians is to help educate families on what happens in the end stages of Alzheimer's disease or when an older person is very frail. And we know that sometimes when we try to introduce food and fluids to a body that's starting that downhill process, we actually can make that person uncomfortable. They can get nauseous or sick to their stomach and get cramps. They can get diarrhea.
So in some ways, you're suggesting that by intervening in this way, you may be sustaining life in the short term, but you're creating more problems?
Exactly. And there's been a number of studies that showed that we get to the same endpoint in almost the same amount of time, whether we add a feeding tube or not.
So in other words, it doesn't forestall death.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't postpone the end result, which is someone passing away, and it might actually make them worse in the short run. So, for example, we think that a feeding tube can reverse malnutrition, and we know that's not true because the body may be starting to shut down so that liquid isn't getting absorbed, and instead the person may get diarrhea.
That's interesting. So even though you're giving food, the body is not ready to receive it.
Exactly.
Or is refusing to receive it.
Exactly. So it's not getting absorbed, and so that even though we're going through the process of giving them nutrition, it's not really getting to that target and making them better.
Why then, where does the pressure come from to make this decision? In other words, is that information readily given to the family, for example, that this cannot necessarily prolong life and also can cause problems?
I don't think it's universally given. And I don't know if families are ready to hear it, because this is often a very emotional time in a disease process. And if we see someone losing weight and not eating, we want to do everything we can to reverse that and make them better.
So that's been obviously your experience. Makes it very, very tough. What other adverse effects have you noticed or do you know of with tube feeding?
Well, just the process of inserting the tube into the stomach wall can give you local irritation. Some of the
infection, I would think.
Infection. Some of the acid from the stomach can leak out and damage the skin. The tube can get blocked. The tube can get displaced and cause more damage. And it doesn't reduce the concern about food or fluids backing up from the stomach and getting into the lungs.
It doesn't reduce it.
It does not reduce it. There's also new studies that suggest it may speed up the process of skin breakdown or the creation of bed sores, for example. So there's a lot of things that we may be doing, thinking that we're helping, but we may be making the situation more uncomfortable and distressful.
With the growth, with the aging of our population and the more people potentially developing something like Alzheimer's, is there a growing awareness of the potential, you know, detrimental effects of using these tubes?
I think we're on the very beginning stages of helping families understand what it looks like at the end stages when somebody is older, whether they have other medical problems or if they have the final stages of Alzheimer's disease. I think we have to help families understand this, and it's a very emotional time, so it can be difficult. So it may be helpful to talk about this before you're in the middle of an emotional decision-making process.
You said something that I thought was so crucial, and that was that when families have to make these decisions, it's often in a crisis. You know, mom or dad is doing poorly. They're kind of going downhill quickly. And we alluded to the fact that if those kinds of decisions were made early on or even before perhaps there was the issue of dementia in life. So we have this whole area, I know that there's been a lot of talk about this whole notion of the importance of what we call advanced directives or making your wishes known to your family. And I know there's been a lot of push nationally to have people put their ideas down in some way. Tell us about that. What are some of your thoughts?
Well, this is on the list of those difficult conversations that nobody really wants to have, but they're just so important to know and to discuss. And so you want to try to get a sense of what your mother or father or other relative would want done in a situation that may not happen for several years.
Or ever, for example.
Or ever. But it's important to have that knowledge and understanding. And on top of that, we need to know what things we can really, as a medical community, reverse and make better, and which things we can't.
And so there have to be realistic expectations.
There has to be realistic expectations. And Alzheimer's disease is a terminal illness. So the end stages of the disease are really very similar to having metastatic cancer of some sort. And we know that we can't make it all better.
That there's really nothing short. There are things that can be done to that are palliative, but not necessarily curative.
Well, the focus is on taking care of the person, making them comfortable, but we're not going to make their underlying problem better. So when we start to see someone have problems with swallowing, that's often an indication that we're approaching the final stages of the disease. And families need to understand that there is no pill that will make that better.
Well, let's back up for a minute. Let's get back to the advanced directives. What seems to stand in the way? I mean, it seems somewhat obvious to me why someone would be a little gun-shy of using these or filling these things out. But in your experience, what stands in the way of people doing this, expressing their wishes, putting it down in writing, or at least having the conversation?
Well, I think the topic is difficult because it talks about all the things we're going to withhold and what we're not going to do. And I think we need to shift the conversation and talk about the things that we will do. So we will do things to help keep your loved one comfortable, make sure they have no pain. We will give them any food or fluids they want to take by mouth, as much as they can tolerate it, and as long as it maintains comfort. But we won't try to force feed them and insert a feeding tube to make sure that they're getting liquid nutrition and fluids, since we know in the long run that doesn't help someone live longer, and it often can make their remaining time more uncomfortable.
So getting back to the idea, though, when you were, let's say, before actual dementia were to set in, or just in a general conversation with an aging person, you might want to talk about, you know, what would happen if should you have this illness or should you have that illness. You're suggesting that we need to change the focus from one of I don't want this done, I don't want this done, I don't want this done, to these are the things I would like done. And how do you think that helps the whole process?
Well, I think everybody is afraid that nobody will take care of you and that you will be abandoned by your doctor and your nurses if you're not actively fighting your disease. And I think that is the underlying fear, is that everybody will kind of ignore you and you'll be on your own. And that is not true. I think the medical community, doctors and nurses, are still willing and able and ready to take care of people, even if we know we can't cure them. We can always take care of people and make sure that they're comfortable.
And that's all the more reason why that conversation needs to be had, so that as much as anything, not just only for the patient, but for the family or for the healthcare proxy, whomever is involved in the caring for this person, understands what to expect and what can realistically be done.
Exactly. I think that we always want to maintain hope, but we also have to temper that with what is realistic and what could actually happen. And that's a very hard balance sometimes to strike, because we never want to see our loved ones pass away.
That's the unfortunate actual bottom line truth.
That's the bottom line.
So let's go back quickly over some of the myths that come along with using the feeding tube. The idea is that somehow you're heroically going to restore nutrition and the person may rally. I mean, what are some of the concepts that are obviously not true or fallacious? What are they thinking?
Well, they think you put in a feeding tube and most of the feeding supplements are liquid nutrition. So after we're out of the infant period, we're used to eating solid food. So now you're expecting the body to absorb liquids, and we don't do that as well as we get older. And so we give all sorts of high energy, high vitamin content liquid preparations, but they don't actually get absorbed. In many cases, they pass right through the person, and then they get diarrhea. And then that increases their chance of getting irritation and skin breakdown, and it can change the fluid balance in their body. so that we're not really helping them feel better, because that makes them feel very uncomfortable.
So there's also this notion of allowing someone to quote-unquote starve to death. I mean, there's the fear that the person will be feeling the effects of hunger, and that's not necessarily true.
No, that's not very true at all, and nobody is really starving in the classic sense in that their body is missing food. Because the body is slowly starting to shut down, it is not missing food in the same way as you might be hungry when you're younger. So actually forcing food into that situation causes more disruption to the internal organs and to the body.
And as you said, all kinds of vomiting, diarrhea, disturbances in their electrolyte imbalance, breakdowns of their skin, a whole list of things that, that these feeding tubes can do. So let's get to something a little more positive. So, because it seems to me a family has to feel, those that care for this individual, that they want to do something. What can be done?
Well, I think what we do is we experiment with things that might be pleasant for eating. Hand feeding is very important. It gives families that sense that they're helping. As long as it's not making the person uncomfortable or irritated in any way. Some of our final taste buds to remain are those for sweet and salty things. So this is not the time to worry about lemon pepper garlic sauce. It may be very simple as ice cream or something sweet that may be used. You can experiment with finger foods or different positions in bed that might help someone swallow better. It helps to maintain that human contact that's so important toward the end, rather than someone having a tube in with a bag of fluid just flowing in and really no human contact to that degree.
So the idea is comfort feeding is the idea and what works, and not so much this notion of trying to pile drive high levels of nutrition into a person at that stage of life.
Exactly. So we don't worry about whether it's low cholesterol or high cholesterol or too salty or too sweet. We figure out whatever that person wants, and we do our best to introduce it. If they don't feel like eating, then we let it pass for that day or for that meal.
Well, it's a very difficult decision. Clearly needs to be conversations before the crisis occurs, but obviously you've laid out all of the potential that there is to make improvements and to help people even at that very difficult, dire time. So thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Sharon Brangman, Professor of Medicine and Division Chief of Geriatrics for Upstate Medical University. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.